You've heard the president say it. President Donald Trump calls his private resort in Florida the Winter White House. And people looking to influence the Trump administration or show other people they've got an in with Trump have become members of Mar-a-Lago. We're talking about what happens in Palm Beach and why it matters to Americans. This is The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina in for Kate Archer-Kent, and there's room for you in this discussion. The number to call is 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about what happens at Mar-a-Lago? What are your thoughts about its connection to Donald Trump as president in the White House? And what do you think about presidents owning businesses while they're in office? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Sarah Blaski is the co-author of the book The Grifters Club, Trump, Mar-a-Lago, and the Selling of the Presidency. She's an investigative reporter at the Miami Herald. She's also from Madison, Wisconsin. Sarah, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
President Trump bought Mar-a-Lago, this luxury resort in Palm Beach, in 1985. What should we understand about what it takes to become a member of Mar-a-Lago and how that relates to the president?
Well, back in the day when he bought Mar-a-Lago, it was a private residence. And then when it became too expensive for him to maintain himself, he turned it into a club in the 1990s. Originally, he had to sort of make incentives for people to want to be members of the club. He opened it up. It was one of the most progressive clubs in Palm Beach. It basically took all of the members that this very white, very elite society wouldn't take into the other country clubs. It was the only club in town to allow Black members. Again, this was a business decision to try to get people to be members of his club to pay that initial fee of $50,000. Now it costs $250,000 to be a member of the club. That price has spiked since Donald Trump became president, and people have really wanted to get close to this president, and the club is the easiest way to get there if you've got that money.
And yet there's a cap on memberships, right?
That's right. So when he made this historic estate in Palm Beach a club, the town was not thrilled and they put a cap on membership. So now there are only 500 membership slots. And as we started to see those fill up at the beginning of the Trump presidency, the entry fee went from $100,000 again to $250,000 now, or really whatever someone's willing to pay.
This week, we've been watching the Republican National Convention. Do you see any connections between people at the convention and Mar-a-Lago?
Yeah, so going through the speakers list, I would say 75% to 80% of the speakers have spent time at Mar-a-Lago. And that's not really surprising to me, because Mar-a-Lago for this president represents the place that he's at home, the place where he feels most comfortable, and it's the place where he trusts the most people. So if you want to grab the ear of this president, Mar-a-Lago is your best bet. And a lot of these speakers have done just that. The other thing I kind of want to say about the RNC that I found interesting is that the idea of who Donald J. Trump is in private has come up, especially last night. And I think Mar-a-Lago is the place where we can see that person. And what we see is that he's very charming at this club. He is dedicated to giving his members what they want. And I think that's kind of how he plays politics, too. He plays to his base. He gives his base what they want. His ideology is very fluid, to the extent that there isn't even a platform for this RNC. That's not really surprising, because that's the same way he approaches everything from food to musicians at his club. It's, hey, what do you want, Joe? You liking this musician? Are you not liking this musician? And so I really think we learn a lot about the president himself by looking at his interactions with his club members.
Sarah Blaski is an investigative reporter at the Miami Herald, and we're talking about her work looking into Mar-a-Lago, the private club owned by the president, and how it relates to his role as president of our country. You can ask your question at 800-642-1234. What do you think about presidents owning businesses, or how they relate private businesses to a public role of service as president of the United States? 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. in this new book that you and other reporters have coming out called The Grifters Club, you say Mar-a-Lago is in some ways a shadow government. What do you mean by that?
I think the best example of this that we know of right now was actually reported by ProPublica originally, and that is the sort of shadow administration that took over the Office of Veterans Affairs in Washington. So there is a Mar-a-Lago member. His name is Ike Perlmutter. He is the CEO of Marvel Comics, and he has been a member for a long time. And so he has known President Trump for much longer than President Trump has been involved in politics. And that length of the relationship matters a lot. President Trump is someone who values loyalty. And so Ike Perlmutter had a leg up on basically anyone in Washington, D.C. when President Trump took over the White House. And so what we saw was he leaned on people like Ike to give him recommendations. And so Ike Perlmutter has been able to give recommendations as to who should be the director, has been sort of pulling the strings in this office from Mar-a-Lago for a long time now. Of course, he says he was doing this with the best of intentions, that he just really wanted to see reforms in the Office of Veterans Affairs. But as we have heard from other people within the government, you know, that was, despite the intentions being really solid, that was sometimes a problem. This is a person who had no government experience. This is a person who had never stepped foot in a VA hospital. And so you can kind of see how that starts to muddy the waters. But again, this is someone that the President Trump really trusted because of the length of their relationship at Mar-a-Lago. And so you see that happen. You also see sort of a second degree of that happen. People who maybe aren't really focused on one single office in Washington, but kind of use their proximity, literally the proximity of their dinner table at Mar-a-Lago to the president, to try to shape everything from, you know, an example would be international politics and national security. One member tried to orchestrate, you know, the next summit between North Korea and the United States by bringing some Mongolian diplomats to dinner and catching the president's eye. So this kind of thing happens at all levels at the club quite frequently. This is the best place, again, to catch the president's attention and push whatever it is you're pushing to the forefront of his mind.
And even if you don't gain direct access to the president, you can tell your supporters, hey, I'm here and I'm close to him, right?
Yes. So that's actually one of the things that surprised me most as I was digging in with my colleagues to this club was, of course, there are these higher levels of influence. And that was what initially got the attention of the national press. But actually more common is the sort of side hustles that some people have set up. And what I mean by that is some members or friends of members, people that have repeat access to this club, often build their own business brands around this perceived proximity to the president. For example, the radio and TV personality Wayne Allen Root was able to sort of build a Trump-focused media brand around his closeness. And that closeness came from a member of Mar-a-Lago who he's friends with, who could get him in to sort of have dinner near and or with the president. Another example is
Let me pause you right there.
Yeah,
we'll circle back to it. Author and investigative journalist Sarah Blaski stays with us as we dive deeper into connections made at Mar-a-Lago. And we're taking your calls, your questions about these circumstances where the president owns a private resort he refers to as the Winter White House. 800-642-1234. This is The Morning Show. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina, and we're talking about the real, perceived, and confusing combination of power and influence people who go to Mar-a-Lago have on the Trump administration. We are talking with Sarah Blaski, who's an investigative reporter at the Miami Herald, and she is also one of the authors on a new book about this. And we're taking your calls, your questions about these connections between the president's private resort and his public role at 800-642-1234. And Sarah, I just want to help people understand your second example of ways that people who have memberships or go to events at Mar-a-Lago are able to use even that trip, even if they haven't talked with the president, to their advantage in saying, I have some influence, whether it's true.
Right. And so one of the examples that I think is best for this is actually the example of a South Florida, a former owner of South Florida massage parlors. Her name is Cindy Yang, and she kind of hit the national spotlight last year because it turns out that she had shifted her focus from owning spas to a new business that she thought was going to make her a lot of money. And that was selling access to the president through Mar-a-Lago. And so she had gotten an in through Mar-a-Lago members and started basically helping promote parties there. And by doing this, she was able to get many selfies with the president and his family, and then use those selfies online to advertise to Chinese businessmen and women who had fairly deep pockets her access, and to say to them, hey, if you want photos like this with the president, come to me and I'll set it all up. Sometimes these tours cost tens of thousands of dollars just for the chance to maybe see the president at Mar-a-Lago at one of these parties. But people bought them because in China in particular, having these photos is very lucrative. It helps one have the upper hand in business negotiations. And so this was a great business for her while it lasted. But it also has a lot of implications. Sure, on the forefront, it puts money into the president's pocket anytime anyone comes to that club. But it also creates national security questions. A lot of these guests, all of these guests, are not vetted by Secret Service when they come into these parties. All they need is a valid ID and a name on a list. And so, we've seen that play out in some interesting ways over the last year.
We've got Ryan from Black River Falls who wants to join the conversation. Good morning, Ryan.
Morning.
What's on your mind?
I guess, as I sit here and listen, I can't help but think that, it seems to me that every time we go down this road, we've got to try to find something wrong with the president and how much he's corrupt and how much influence he gets from outside sources. There's no president that doesn't go somewhere and do something with somebody, and you could always say it's got potential for corruption. When he plays to his base, that's what a president is supposed to do when he does what the people want him to do. So, you said earlier that, he caters to his base. So that he doesn't really cater to his base as much as he is there for anybody. Anybody's life matters to him. And I think you can see that when you watch the RNC.
Okay, thanks for that, Ryan. I want to give our guest an opportunity to respond, though, because Ryan's saying the president is a politician. All presidents cater to the people who support them. Isn't that what's happening here?
I think a lot of that is true, and I think that's an important point to make. There certainly is an element of all presidents do play to their base. All presidents tend to give ambassadorships to their friends and allies. That happens routinely. I think what's distinct here is that this president has this one unique opening, this place that is both his official residence, that he has attempted at least to make his official residence, and is also a country club with thousands of people going in and out each and every weekend while he's there. And so what that means is this kind of influence happens away from the press, away from any type of oversight or scrutiny, and also that it is routine and common. And I think to the listener's point, one of the interesting things is you can take what you want from this book, whether or not you think this is a good thing, but I think this really does give us insight into the psyche of the president. I think we really can begin to understand this man as someone that, again, doesn't have a solid ideology, unless that is of this mentality of a party host. And also, I think one thing that has struck a chord in particular with Republicans that I spoke to for this book is that there are serious national security concerns at this club because of the way that it's run. So corruption, money, any of those questions aside, I think that we can all find solid and common ground in thinking that the president of the United States is a number one security or espionage target, and his safety is a number one national security concern. And this club is a problem in that sphere.
Ryan, thanks for the call at 800-642-1234. We're talking with Sarah Blaski, who's an investigative reporter at the Miami Herald, co-author of the new book, The Grifters Club, about President Trump and Mar-a-Lago. Last week, Sarah, former White House chief strategist Steve Bannon was arrested for fraud related to funding for a campaign to build a wall. His arrest also brought to light another person linked to Mar-a-Lago. That's a Chinese dissident named Guo Wengui. And Guo is seeking asylum in the U.S., but then he's also been accused of being a spy for the Chinese government. How has Guo's Mar-a-Lago membership benefited him here?
Right. So this goes back to, what do people really gain from being members? And in Guo's case, he's been a member for longer than Donald Trump has been a politician, or at least before he declared his candidacy. And what ended up happening is this became very important for him when President Trump was considering a Chinese request to deport Guo back to China. You know, this could create an international relations fiasco, and Trump's aides were very aware of this. And so they were trying to find ways to talk the president out of this deportation, out of considering this deportation request. And what they said, according to reporting, is that they told the president, hey, this man is a member of your club. You don't want to deport him. And so he didn't. And so that's just one way being a member of the club has benefited Mr. Guo. And, you know, the other interesting thing about this example of Bannon's arrest is that also Brian Colfage, who started the We Build the Wall thing, has also been to Mar-a-Lago, and goes back to my original point of many people who want to look close to the president or be close to the president visit this club. In Brian's case, he went to an event hosted by the Trumpets, this sort of cheerleader group for the president. And he used a picture that he took with one of the president's adult sons to promote We Build the Wall. And this really does build credibility. It gives the appearance that there is a closer relationship between the whatever the business is and the Trump administration and the president of the United States.
The election is just more than 2 months away. How do you see things at Mar-a-Lago changing if Trump, you know, remains our president, or if he loses the presidency?
I think this is a great question that I think about a lot. So what we know from the finances is that initially, during the presidency, the bottom line at Mar-a-Lago increased. Lots of revenue was coming in. But then the club took a revenue hit after Charlottesville, after the president suggested that there were good people on both sides. Actually, didn't suggest, said, I should say, that there were good people amongst the neo-Nazi crowd there. And that basically caused a bunch of big charities to leave the club, not host their galas there, and there was a revenue shortfall. Now, it's still above pre-presidential levels. And the reason I'm talking about this is I wonder if some of this fall off of revenue was inevitable, that we saw a spike at the beginning because of new memberships, and we were always going to see this downward trajectory, or if this is reflective of people's distaste for the president's politics. I do think that we might be seeing an evening out, and I do think that there will always be interest in this club. There always has been. And I think some of that will remain tied up with the president's political brand, if and when he leaves office, if that's next year or in 4 years. But I do think that there will be some people that will continue to want to be members there, will continue to want to visit. And I do think overall, this is probably still a good move for the president's financial bottom line, even after the presidency.
Sarah Blaski, we have just scratched the surface of your reporting. Thank you for joining us and talking with it today.
Thank you for having me.
Sarah Blaski is an investigative reporter at the Miami Herald. She's also co-author of the book out this month called The Grifters Club, Trump, Mar-a-Lago, and the Selling of the Presidency. Up next is news. Then an activist from Kenosha tells us how the community is mourning and taking action after the shooting and serious injury of Jacob Blake and the protests that have happened after that. I'm Keely Boltina. This is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Join us tonight at 8 o'clock for live NPR coverage of the Republican National Convention. This is the last night. It's a mix of live and virtual events as Donald Trump accepts the party's nomination for president. That's tonight starting at 8 o'clock on Wisconsin Public Radio and at WPR.org. It's The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina in for Kate Archer Kent. Wisconsin's attorney general has released details about Sunday night's shooting of Jacob Blake and violence that's happened in the aftermath. Last night was a fourth night of protests. A Kenosha police officer shot Jacob Blake, a black man, 7 times in the back. His family says he's paralyzed and in the hospital. While headlines about police brutality and racial injustice now pointed squarely at Kenosha this week, local activists have been working for months, for years, on improving the connection between law enforcement and people of color. Isaac Wallner is a lifelong resident of Kenosha and a local organizer. He founded the Human First Project, which is an organization focused on social and racial justice. Isaac, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you.
What happened on Sunday when you found out Jacob Blake had been shot? What did you do?
I got a phone call from a member of a coalition I'm in saying that there was an African-American man shot in the back by police in Kenosha. And I was sleeping at the time, but I woke up, got down there on scene shortly about a half hour after the shooting. And from that point, I really just took a role to document what was going on down there. And I live streamed for about 3 hours that night. I was on the ground for about 6. Really just trying to show the world at that point what was going on when on the street and people's reactions to the shooting, and really give that firsthand look about what was going on down there. And after that, I took an organizing role to organize some more events and to really just kind of be there for people and help keep the peace down there and be supportive of what's going on.
Why did you realize that you needed to go, that you needed to be there on the ground and talking with people?
It's just after George Floyd, I was organizing peaceful protests, organized 3 peaceful protests over the course of the summer. And I felt that it was my personal calling to go down there and use the platform I established with the protests after George Floyd's killing to take that down there and continue to be a voice of peace, because I always kept a peaceful message. It required peace at my protests. So I felt to go down there and, you know, carry that peaceful message and be down there to just help people navigate through their emotions and help just guide them through and, you know, get them out safely. And along with my coalition, we're in to help people when it comes to medical needs, or again, just to guide them through and make sure they get out of there and they're safe.
When people began to gather in that area on Sunday night, you know, you saw what they were doing, how they were connecting. What do you want people who weren't there to understand about why people crowded together?
I want people to know that although at the initial scene there were, as the world may know, there were some destruction of police property. The world knows that an officer took a brick to the back of the head. There were some things that happened down there. But in the heat of the moment, though, overall, it was relatively, there's a lot of anger, but at the same time, there was still a level of peace as well. That especially that didn't, you see, you know, the stuff that happened after that when it comes to the destruction of property, burning things down, and the killing of two individuals the other night. But at that site, after the shooting, people were angry. They wanted answers. They really didn't want to cause destruction and harm to people. They wanted answers. And upon leaving there, they gathered at the police station and demanded answers. But in the heat of the moment, there's a lot of frustration for when you see things go on around the country when it comes to what I describe open season on Black people, when it comes to their life and who they are and their livelihood. There's a lot of pent-up frustration when you get to watch this happen time and time again and nothing happens to these police officers who are doing these shootings. So then when it hits home and they're essentially keeping the officer on their payroll, giving them some sort of immunity and not firing them, a lot of frustration builds from that. But even then, we move from that night, they're having very, very, very peaceful protests that disband around that curfew hour. And after that, you have people such as your militia and people who come in from the outside agitators that come into our city to cause mayhem, to cause havoc. But I want people to know, though, that Kenosha is, its residents are, it's, we're a great city. We have great residents, and we have been assembling peacefully. And I want people to know that that does happen. We're not, there's protesters, there's rioters, there's a militia, and they're not all one and the same.
Isaac Wallner is a lifelong resident of Kenosha, also a local organizer. And you can join our conversation about what's happening in Kenosha by calling 800-642-1234. What is the relationship between your community and its police department? How comfortable would you feel calling officers to your neighborhood? Do you see police regularly? What's it like in your part of Wisconsin? 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Isaac, I notice you mentioned we. I mean, we're talking about the fact that you've grown up in Kenosha, you live in Kenosha, and you do this work in Kenosha. How important is it to recognize that people in Kenosha are trying to stand up for injustice and in a way they think is right?
It's very important. It's very important to understand that we need equality. It's not up for debate. Like, people want to debate it. It's a must. We have to have it. This Constitution was written to give equality for everybody, not to pick and choose who can have it. And it's not to try to navigate it and make it your own to appeal to only a certain amount of people. When things like that start to happen, we're going to start to grasp for ways to have our voices be heard. And when they're not being heard, things are going to happen and escalate because we're not being heard. And so it's very important to understand that what we're out here doing, whether people agree with it or not, we're trying to be heard, and we don't agree with being treated unjustly solely based on the color of our skin. And I need people to understand that. People want to focus on the reaction. So they want to focus on the destruction and the protesting and people staying out past curfew. But they ignore the action that caused all this. They ignore the fact that an officer shot somebody in the back 7 times, and it fits the narrative. A white officer shoots a Black person in the back, or shoots a Black person unjustly. It fits the narrative, and it keeps happening time and time and time again. So at what point do we have, at what point do we stop? At what point do people catch on that this is happening to us and we need their support and not their criticism and not them putting us down, but rather uplift us and join the cause with us and help get our voices out there, because we're powerful in numbers. You hear the term "we the people," and people forget, though, that the government, they work for us. We the people are powerful. If we can come together and not divide, we can make things right for everybody.
We do see that narrative playing out with Jacob Blake of a white officer and a black man being shot. And then we have people standing up for racial justice, but then we have this tension again, right? We have the protesters and we have police officers and other law enforcement working those scenes, telling people what to do, asking them to stay in line, both sides using violence at times. When you've encountered police during these protests and the crowds gathered, how do you interpret how they've interacted with demonstrators?
They, on the scene, especially that the night of the shooting, they took up a position of power to control the crowd. And I really feel that in those moments, you have to, people are angry, and rightfully so. So I really feel there needs to be some, at least one person there who is going to talk to the crowd, whether or not the crowd's going to be receptive or the crowd may answer back in anger, but somebody there to tell the, you know, the officers to, hey, take a couple steps back, you know, relax your posture, because you look aggressive, and aggression just feeds aggression. And then they put on their riot gear, and that's just they're escalating. They're not de-escalating. And I feel like de-escalation in those moments is important. And it eventually escalated to a point where violence happened. And then when you look at things over the past couple of nights, they were, when the National Guard got called in and they had a co-op between other police departments to come down to Kenosha to help control things, they were at the area of the courthouse, and eventually they came up with Bearcats, which are their heavy vehicles, armored vehicles, on a loudspeaker, instructing people to go home, saying they're in violation of the curfew. And they started using pepper rounds, which are like paintballs that shoot out a spray of pepper, and they shoot the ground around you. And they're shooting those from the roof of the courthouse and from the Bearcats at protesters. And so it does get hectic at times, but I really think that there can be other ways to de-escalate the situation.
Yeah. Isaac, I'm going to jump in here. We're talking with Isaac Wallner, who's a lifelong resident of Kenosha and a local organizer. We continue talking with Isaac here on The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina, and you're listening to The Ideas Network. Protests in Kenosha over the police shooting of Jacob Blake, a black man, have been violent. Protesters threw bottles and fireworks, police wearing riot gear and spraying tear gas, and a white 17-year-old who showed up with other armed civilians is charged with killing two people Tuesday night at the demonstration. We're looking through the news reports and getting context for the situation in Kenosha. It's The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina. You can join us by calling 800-642-1234. Do you see police officers around your neighborhood regularly? How well do you know them? Do you feel safer knowing officers are nearby? 800-642-1234. Kenosha is Isaac Wallner's hometown. Isaac founded the Human First Project, which is an organization focused on social and racial justice. Isaac, lots of people are looking at Kenosha right now, but these conversations have been going on long before Sunday. What was the relationship like between the community and Kenosha police before this shooting?
There has been tension between the community and the Kenosha police before the shooting, and there has been a disconnect between the African-American population, you know, in the population that is poverty-stricken, those neighborhoods such as them over-policing the neighborhoods, and but then when something happens, such as a shooting, they come in there, they do their job, and they disappear instead of, you know, really being there to support the neighborhood and uplift it and try to make it better. They're more there just to police it and to almost, in a sense, bully the neighborhood and be overpowering to just show power, not show support. And so I really feel that disconnect and that overuse of power is what burnt that bridge, is what keeps that bridge separated. And I refer to community policing, where they could be out there as a community, as a service more than it is as a power, and be there to, you know, try to bridge that gap and show their faces, maybe walk a beat like they did back in the day, so kids can see them as friendly and as polite and not fear the police officers.
We've got Don in Fish Creek who has a question here this morning. Good morning, Don.
Good morning, and thank you for the show, and thank you to your guest, Isaac, I think. Anyway, I'm about as far away from a city as you can get. I'm up in northeast Wisconsin, but I can't wonder about the failure of our state legislature on a number of issues, from even, you know, rejecting Governor Evers' calls for even mild gun control, which could be applied to some of these vigilante-type white supremacists. I wrote a letter to my state assemblyman, Joel Kitchens, Republican of Sturgeon Bay, who several years ago introduced the Blue Lives Matter legislation, and I wrote a couple letters to the editor, decrying that. It's like, you know, it originated as a white supremacist response to Black Lives Matter movement in, I think, Louisiana or Alabama, and then it was picked up around the country. And this kind of neglect from our state legislatures on a number of levels, from poverty, which your guest, as the root cause of a lot of the trouble right now, from the pandemic to anything, our state legislative majority doing nothing.
Yeah. Don, let's talk with Isaac about it. Thanks for that point. And Isaac, you know, Don brings up this idea of state legislation, and you're working in your community. I mean, are there things that we need to do at the state level? Does this have to happen organically, locally? How do we solve for some of these challenges?
You have to clean up these neighborhoods, give these neighborhoods that are poverty stricken some hope. They're coming into the city and they're trying to revamp the downtown, spending all this money to give us a better downtown, and talks about putting in high rises and shops and all these things for the downtown. But what about investing into your community and cleaning things up, giving us better schools, cleaning the schools up, putting in parks and neighborhoods that are in walking distance for kids to go to and enjoy themselves and have a good time, instead of investing money into a downtown and putting in jobs that don't even pay enough for a person to work there a full-time job and be able to afford their livelihood. But yet, at the end of the day, it's a business and you're making somebody rich off of that business, but yet the employees there still can't afford to live. So you're putting in more businesses that aren't paying a livable wage, and you get these people from these neighborhoods that are working them, but still can't afford to even hardly even shop or enjoy what that business is. So to me, there should be this on the state side of things, create whether it's funding for projects to clean up the neighborhoods and, you know, give these neighborhoods hope and put up, you know, housing for the homeless population and be able to, like, there shouldn't be people sleeping on the street in our city.
Isaac,
when you think of, go ahead.
I was just going to mention that Isaac Wallner is a lifelong resident of Kenosha, also founded the Human First Project, which is an organization focused on social and racial justice. And Isaac, you are organizing a community-wide candlelight vigil and prayer for Jacob Blake, who has had surgery, is reportedly paralyzed after police shot him on Sunday. Why is this the next step? Why is this event so important?
I feel it's important to gather everybody in a very peaceful manner and to support Jacob Blake and his family and to show us that we are Kenosha strong and we can gather peacefully and that we are able to do this in a unified way that A, the world can see, because that we've been seeing on the news, chaos, the city burning down, the loss of life, and be able to show Kenosha standing together in a peaceful manner to stand up in solidarity for Jacob Blake and his family, I feel is very important.
What are you and other members of the Kenosha Accountability Coalition that was formed after the death of George Floyd, what are you doing now? Now that this has happened, this has escalated so much in your hometown, what are you going to do to try to have more conversations with police or with community members? Have you figured out where to start?
We're meeting to figure out a list of things that we feel from community input will help to better the community, and then taking that and eventually running that up into like state legislation and as well as local elected officials, and trying to find a way to make this community safer and better for all. And it's really just coming together, and we have to build we have traction with what we've been doing, but now it's time to mobilize and build a list of demands, if you will, and things we want to see change policy-wise. And that's what we're doing right now.
Do you think local leaders, state leaders, will take you seriously?
We're strong in numbers, and we've been on the ground. They've seen that. They know that. And I feel like when we approach them with actually being out there and having support from the community, I really do feel they will, because we all have support. We're backed by the community. We've been out here since George Floyd, and we haven't stopped. And we've been consistent. The momentum has kept going, and the momentum will keep going. And if they don't listen the first time around, we're here to stay, and we're not going to stop.
Isaac Wallner, thank you for talking to us about what you're doing in your hometown. We appreciate your time.
Welcome. Thank you.
Isaac Wallner is a lifelong resident of Kenosha. He's also a local organizer who founded the Human First Project. It's an organization focused on social and racial justice. Just ahead, we've got an author exploring girlhood, including her personal struggles with gender and identity. It's about a book called Tomboy Land, and she grew up right here in Wisconsin. I'm Keely Boltina. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.